Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
We bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Oh, yeah.
Don't
you know, burn too many things we found. That's a wonderful Dara Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, as usual, with our Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Hour. Thank you, Jesse and the crew in New York. We got a fabulous show today with a great, great guest, a good old buddy of mine, as brilliant as they come, as dedicated and hardworking and activist as I've ever known, Alan Minsky. Alan, are you with us?
Oh, shucks, Harvey, that's too kind.
I haven't heard shucks on this show, I think, ever. We may get a call from Mimi Kennedy. Mimi is driving. Mimi, you on? Okay, well, if she makes it, she does. It's a wonderful thing. But, Alan, you are the head. And, folks, I want you to listen in because this is a rare opportunity to talk with someone who really knows what he's doing here. You are currently running Progressive Democrats of America. Tell us what that's all about.
Well, certainly I would say that, I've come into this position as the executive director of PDA. I am always not somebody who is comfortable with hierarchy as such, and certainly I think the operation is run by the phenomenal, hardworking staff at PDA. But I do accept the responsibility of the role and the whole sort of buck stops here notion. So I take on that, I accept that role, and I do, along with the staff and the boards, advisory board and the board members, and the whole broad family of PDA, work on, setting a course for victories, for real significant victories for left progressives in the United States of America in the political system, in order to transform the society into something that is much more equitable and much more in the spirit of the matriarchal traditions in the United States of America that you outline in your brilliant new book, The People's Spiral of U.S. History. It is just a great book, Harvey, and you set out from the very beginning to, foreground the contrast between the indigenous traditions and the traditions of the conquistadors and the European settler colonialists. And we at PDA, working pragmatically inside the 2019 reality of American society, we really work hard nonstop to advocate on behalf of progressive legislation, progressive policies, on every issue, every nook and cranny of American society, to really just make sure that this tremendous new progressive wave of enthusiasm in American politics, sparked in part by the Bernie Sanders campaign in the wake of the Occupy movement, moved forward further by the election of the Squad in 2018 into the House of Representatives, and now we are in a situation where we have, really, truly great proposals on the table that the American public supports, and we're in a battle between the status quo forces versus the forces of the better angels of our nature, and we are fighting every day to try to make sure that good guys prevail in this.
Well, what exactly does Progressive Democrats of America do? If I'm a member of PDA, and I participate in and donate and do all that stuff, What's the work agenda?
Well, PDA is actually three different organizations. Okay, it's the Progressive Democrats of America. Formerly, that is a federal PAC. Don't be scared; it's an independent PAC. It is entirely motivated by trying to support progressive candidates, whether they're challenging Democratic incumbents, they're running for open seats, or they're running to challenge a Republican incumbent, or they're an incumbent themselves. and that is Progressive Democrats of America. Now, we have two 501c4s, which are not officially allowed to advocate on behalf of candidates except to their membership, and one is our federal lobbying wing called People Demanding Action, in which I have a parallel executive director named activist named Andrea Miller. So Andrea is the executive director of People Demanding Action, which is, again, PDA's federal lobbying wing. And then we have another 501c4 called Progressives for Democracy in America. And I think people can catch that both of those have the initials PDA. And that is our instrument for state-local lobbying. It's also our instrument for local chapter formation. And what local chapters can do in terms of state and local lobbying. And they are both chapters of Progressives for Democracy in America and Progressive Democrats of America. So what does the parent organization do? It primarily, three-quarters of its energy per the Federal Election Commission laws, are about nominating and promoting and independently campaigning, not in coordination with the actual campaigns, but independently advocating on behalf of candidates that it endorses. So right now, if you're a PDA supporter, you get to participate right in this period right now in polls as to which candidates we're going to support in primaries. PDA is an organization that exists to transform the Democratic Party into a progressive party. And we are legally allowed to use the word Democrat so long as we only endorse Democrats or people who are not members of other parties, so independents who caucus with the Democrats. So, for instance, we could endorse Bernie Sanders in Vermont. But other than that, other than an independent who is clearly committed to caucusing with the Democratic Party, we do only endorse Democrats. So, again, we see that as in no way undermining what we believe to be our advocacy for true, left-wing, and to use the term to understand what that means coming out of the French Revolution, that means we advocate for political power and economic power for the vast majority of the people, not for the elites. That's what left-wing means coming out of the French Revolution, as I know you know. And so we promote that inside the Democratic Party to try to turn this party into again, something right now in the spirit of the 2016 Sanders campaign, the politics of figures like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and just unabashedly so. And so there are a number of people who have been inspired both by, for instance, the Sanders campaign and by the tremendous success of people like Ayanna Pressley and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who knocked out long-standing more moderate Democrats, although the chap in Massachusetts really wasn't the worst of the corporate Democrats who lost to Presley, and to support candidates who were challenging corporatist Democrats trying to transform the party back into a party that supports policies for the average person in the society, the welfare of the planet, etc. And so that's what PDA does specifically. And then what we also do is we're very much a brass tacks organization, and we are a every issue organization. So we support and advocate for and lobby through our 501c4 channels for every piece of progressive legislation, and there's loads of it. I mean, the way that politics in this country is underreported in the media and the disengagement of the public from the political process is something that we push hard against. We try to inspire people to get involved and support progressive legislation because it's out there. I mean, there are great bills out there that so few people know about. I mean, there's some, big ticket, well-known progressive pieces of legislation, the Green New Deal resolution put forward by Ocasio-Cortez and Markey, Medicare for All put forward by Jayapal and Sanders. But there are tons and tons of other fantastic pieces of progressive legislation put out by members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus that's getting stronger and stronger. Under the leadership of Pramila Jayapal and Mark Potan, it's really stepped up to another level. I think before this era, it was almost unknown by the general public. Now it's a force within Congress. It's the largest caucus. And, of course, there are members of the Progressive Caucus who are less progressive rather than more so. But Pramila Jayapal, if people don't know that name, They probably know Mark Pocan from his appearances on the Tom Hartman show, but Pramila Jayapal is every bit as brilliantly great a progressive as AOC and Bernie Sanders, and she's just driving the Progressive Caucus to new heights, and we have a real opportunity to transform our politics here in the United States, to rebuild education, to have universal free at the point of cost. I mean, she's Jayapal, for instance, is the author of the House Medicare for All bill, you know, in coordination with National Nurses United, that then was mirrored by Sanders in the Senate. So, you know, there's real promise in American politics, but boy, is there a dark side. And then there's this sort of hideous middle ground, which I think it's domination, so-called middle ground, with the corporate domination of American politics and the Democratic Party, I truly believe begat us, Donald Trump. And we have to defeat those forces. Yeah.
Well, Alan Minsky of PDA, and also, of course, you're still with KPFK in L.A., the Los Angeles, and you are the state, the program director that got me my show there, and
a long time ago. But this is no quid pro quo. Harvey Wasserman is just, first of all, your new book is fantastic. It's a joy to read. It has just got its gander up, and in the best kind of way. It pulls no punches. It openly advocates for, again, the sort of in every stage of American history, as it takes you through American history, any particular episode, well-known or otherwise, in American history, of course, it doesn't cover everything, it would be an infinitely long book then, but it covers every major period of American history, and just turn to it, and you'll have a unique perspective on it, and every single sentence is just sort of a glow with the charm of Harvey's prose style. Which I don't know how to describe it, but it's not Thompson, because it's not, Thompson is too caustically bitter in his, you know, vibrant prose style, Hunter S. Thompson. This is much more it has the vibrancy of the best psychedelic music, but real political conviction behind it. And so
I think you could probably term it as late 60s LSD yippie. Something like that. I don't know, but you know, I am an obsessive revisionist. So I have to say that my prose does not just come flowing out of me, or it does, but then it gets revived and nailed and whatever. But Alan, thank you so much. I'm glad you've been enjoying the book. I do want to reach out before we proceed. I do want to talk with you about American history and the current situation. But we do want to reach out to Bernie Sanders. He did have a health episode, and I guess he now has two stents in his heart area, and we wish him well. He's definitely planning to come back on the campaign trail. I was moved, actually, by, you know, I don't watch regular TV, but I do make a point of watching the YouTube replay of Colbert, and I was moved by Colbert really obviously loves Bernie Sanders and was very concerned and reached out to him about this latest health episode. And I will have to say that as a historian, if I were to name the most important activist figure in the 21st century, there's no doubt that it's Bernie Sanders. He has completely changed the dialogue in this country against all odds. And we can't even begin to quantify the debt we owe Bernie Sanders in terms of moving the public dialogue in this country. I mean, I can't imagine where we'd be at if he hadn't jumped in and really done what he's done. And he's been so brilliant and so uncompromising and just, you know, breathtaking in his the scope of his challenge to corporate America. It's just been really tremendous. I think you'd probably want to say something about that.
Well, I certainly do. I mean, first of all, for listeners who don't know, the Bernie Sanders 2016 campaign was brought to you by PDA. Now, I, of course, was not the executive director at the time. In fact, PDA, I'm a little bit of a loud place there. That sound will go away momentarily. And PDA, you can't really speak about it without mentioning the founding executive director, Tim Carpenter. Tim Carpenter started PDA in 2004. In the state of Massachusetts, the state that Harvey has a lot of roots in, right after the John Kerry convention. It was really a point where the progressive wing of the Democratic Party was at a low point, and because the neoliberal corporate takeover of the party, which certainly was solidified by Bill Clinton's election in 1992, really just that wing of the party was utterly dominant as of 2004. And so right after the convention, a couple days later, PDA was founded. And in 2013, folks, the Run Bernie Run campaign to draft Bernie Sanders to run for president, and specifically to do so as a Democrat, was launched by this organization, PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, well before anybody else was involved with that. And over time, we drew in other organizations, but quite a ways later, pretty much all the way through 2014, Run Bernie Run was solely PDA. Maybe by early 2015, we had a few other partners, and we were just everywhere Bernie was. We were telling him to run, trying to get him to throw his hat into the ring and to do so as a Democrat. There was some thought that he would run initially as an independent because, of course, he was an independent from Vermont. But we were instrumental in persuading him not only to run, but to run as a Democrat. And now we've endorsed Bernie Sanders again in this election cycle. And, you know, as an organization that became prominent in this period where the Democratic Party had very little in terms of progressive forces in the party, PDA has had good relationships with a number of other progressives, including Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. But the membership of PDA early on to just an absolutely open vote of all of our national supporters and activists, Sanders cleared our 60% mark on the first ballot, so he is the person we are supporting for president. And we love Bernie Sanders, and everything you just said about Bernie Sanders, I would absolutely agree with. I think that he has transformed American politics through the power of his campaign, through his unwavering conviction to progressive causes across the board. I would say this, though. You know, that's great. That's absolutely brilliant, and it has been transformative. But I look at things this way. Winning elections and getting a progressive president in office, and then winning the necessary elections to have Congress support policies, that is a huge lift for all of us and something we have to achieve in this society. The social crises that are prominent in the United States of America are endemic. And remember, we're talking now supposedly after 10 straight years of economic recovery, when we're no longer in a recession, where we have low unemployment. The wealth inequality in the society is staggering. And what does that mean? That means the average person is just on a gerbil wheel of debt and overwork, having to hold multiple jobs. The ability to have a family in this society and to keep your head above water, the amount of work that requires is way beyond anything that any human society should look upon as acceptable at this point, unless you're to the manor born or close to the manor born. And so we have a lot to do right there. And on top of all of that, right now, humanity, century and a half or more than that now, the Industrial Revolution, the development of a technological society with suburban sprawl and all of that, we're burning ourselves off the planet, and we have to seriously address this existential crisis for humanity. So getting a progressive president, getting a progressive Congress, those are huge lifts. Okay, once we get them, passing the legislation, given that all of the business establishment, all of the money, and yes, this, with all those social and economic distributive problems I just cited, and of course all the racism underlying it too, this is the richest society in the history, in human history, and the money's concentrated in the hands of a few people who will fight with all of their power against the effort to achieve, even with a reorganized Congress and a progressive president, against that legislating passiveness. That's the second massive hurdle. The third hurdle is once those, let's say that we get through over the second, progressive president, progressive Congress, passing progressive legislation, is to have it work. Because we're in a situation, we're basically, people own, they own all the essential resources. I mean, there are many things in the public's hands and they can be put to use. The federal government does have incredible resources. Some state governments also have incredible resources. those are publicly shared assets. But compared to the privately held wealth and the ways in which all the essential resources in society are basically held by corporations or the super wealthy, and all the power that they have, all their ability to hide their money overseas in tax havens, et cetera, has gotten so extremely out of hand that achieving success for the progressive policies is a third huge hurdle. And we're just, even with the great advances Bernie has made, and I think he knows this as much as anybody knows this, we got a long way to go. It's going to be a struggle, and we have to not take our eyes off the prize all the way down the line.
Right. And at this point in time, of course, you know, we're not talking about abstract this and that. We're talking about the survival of the human race. I mean, what Trump has done is really, you know, I see Donald Trump as an alien sent down from another planet to basically wipe out the human race and clear the earth for some other species to come in here. I mean, his policies have been so absolutely destructive and pointedly so that you have to wonder where this guy is really coming from. The shock of Donald Trump is not merely that he's in the White House, but that such a human being could ever exist. I mean, if I had read a novel featuring Donald Trump as he is, I would have found it not credible. So, you know, we have seen a side of the human animal that none of us, I think, were really prepared to deal with. And now we face the big reality. So, Progressive Democrats of America, let's talk. I want to talk about history. You have mentioned the premise of the spiral of U.S. history, people's spiral of U.S. history, being that we were born in matriarchy. And I think people have to understand, and I hope PDA will understand this too. And this is the one I've gotten the most pushback, weirdly enough, from the first readers of this history book, is the idea that American democracy actually comes from the indigenous. You know, American democracy, as we know it today, was born not in Europe. There were no democratic countries in Europe when Europeans started coming here. There was a tradition of democracy from Athens, way, way, way back when, a couple millennia before, that had to do with a town meeting, but women were not allowed, and there were slaves in Athens. I mean, you had a republic in Rome, but it was obviously extremely hierarchical and various, and it disappeared in the Middle Ages. And you can't point in 1492 through 1776 to a democratic country in Europe, small d. But the democracy that really that we have inherited came from the Iroquois. And Benjamin Franklin and even George Washington were very explicit about this. They in their writings and in their speeches, and this was actually confirmed, weirdly enough, with a joint resolution of Congress in the 1980s when Nancy Reagan was running the country, 1988, acknowledging that American democracy came from the indigenous, and it was very much a matriarchal society.
Can I ask you something? Can you go back a second? You just brought Nancy Reagan, and I wasn't quite expecting that. And I was reflecting on Washington and Franklin while you started to mention. Please remind me how Nancy Reagan plays into this.
Well, Nancy Reagan was our second female CEO. Nancy
right,
Reagan
after,
ran
after Wilson's.
Yes, Edith Wilson, right, yeah. Who was absolutely horrible, by the way. And Nancy right. Reagan, you know, I hate to use this term, but she was a hippie in a lot of ways. Nancy Reagan was. Really, she was, you know, terrible in terms of social class and not really nice to people who weren't rich. But she was pro-choice, and if you have to name the two people on top as opposed to the grassroots movements that ended the Cold War, it's Mikhail Gorbachev and Nancy Reagan, not Ronnie Reagan. Ronnie Reagan was out of it by that time. You know, he was old, he had been shot, he had Alzheimer's. Both his son and one of his great supporters, Bill O'Reilly, go to great lengths to point out that Ronnie Reagan was barely conscious in the late 80s. And when the truces were made, the treaties were signed to end the Cold War, it was Nancy Reagan, followed by George H.W. Bush, who did the job. So, while Nancy Reagan was running the country, during the Reagan administration, there was a joint resolution of Congress acknowledging that American democracy and many of our freedoms were rooted not in Europe, but in the Iroquois, the Haudenosaunee. And the Iroquois Confederacy, there was a Congress. Well, there were five nations who were at war constantly, the Mohawk, the Oneida, the Onondaga, the Seneca, and the Cayuga, going across upstate New York now. And there was a peacemaker named Daganoweda, and he may or may not have been real or myth, but there is, he is a real being in the Iroquois culture. He made peace between the five tribes, and they convened a Congress in Onondaga territory, which is in the center of what's now upstate New York. And it was, the chiefs came, the chiefs were all men, but they were chosen by the women. And a woman could remove, the matriarchs of the tribe could remove the male chiefs anytime they wanted. And I saw a wonderful documentary, you'll love the sound, there was a woman named Audrey Shenandoah. And they asked her why it was, if the women ran the tribes, why were the men the chiefs? And she said, well, it makes them feel important, and it gives them something to do. So you have this tradition of matriarchy in American society, and you have democracy. And if you could sit down across the table right now from Ben Franklin and George Washington, and ask them if American democracy was rooted with the Iroquois, they would both of them absolutely not hesitate and say yes. And Tom Paine would say the same. So, at any rate,
interesting, because there was the paradox that going into the revolution, a lot of people felt that the king, getting rid of the king, was something that Americans were all hell bent on. And yet, there's this paradox because people recall that the king was offered, being king was offered to Washington at a certain point.
Well,
and then also that in fact, the people with the Boston Tea Party, et cetera, were appealing to the king, and that the hatred wasn't towards the king, but towards Parliament, which was levying the tax. So that certainly...
Well, also...
Well, go ahead. You know a lot more about it than I do, so go ahead.
Well, also, I'm getting to where we want to talk about the corporate Democrats, but I did want to lay a bit of the foundation. You have to remember that the first major act of the American Revolution, which was the Boston Tea Party, was aimed not at the king and not at Parliament, but at the East India Tea Company, which was the big corporation. Americans were very aware of the corporate power of the East India Tea Company. And they hated that. And it was really an anti-corporate rebellion at that time. Now, corporations were a new entity. And this is the root of our problem, is and the single beast that is destroying human life on earth is not the king, it's not the president, it's not the Congress, and it's not the judiciary, it's the corporation. The corporation is the most powerful institution on earth. And if we are to survive as a species, human beings must take control of the corporations. And I have a piece up now. It's at Reader Supported News and Columbus Free Press and the Smirking Chimp and a few others that basically states that the four things we're going to have to do to save the climate are, you know, have a reasonable... actual elections, which are completely corrupted, and which we can talk about another couple of hours, and you know, that we're going to have to basically take control of the corporations. And if we do not take control of the corporations, the corporations are like an alien beast that are destroying our planet. And you have to remember one thing about the Indians, about the indigenous. You can use the term Indian. The Indians think it's kind of funny. He was the first head of the American Indian Museum on the Smithsonian. He's a really heavy hitter. He was an attorney, I think he was Cheyenne. And I asked him what it felt like to be running the American Indian Museum. And he said, well, we like being called Indians. It reminds us that Columbus was lost. This is a classic indigenous response. So, yes, so our democracy is based in matriarchy, and it's based in consensus, by the way. The Iroquois Confederacy did not work by majority rule. They all had to agree. Now, I don't know if you do that at PDA. We did it for a while at the Clamshell Alliance, and it drove us completely crazy. But, you know, it comes
we don't use consensus at PDA. We hope for.
But you have 60. You have 60% for something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For an endorsement.
So, and then you also
pops up a lot in PDA decision making. And usually we clear it by a long shot.
You do. What pops up a lot in decision making?
60% is a threshold. Because it's our standard for endorsing a candidate, we just seems to come up in a lot of our decision making. But we don't want slim majorities, and we usually are supporting candidates and making decisions on much higher than 60% threshold, close to consensus, complete consensus.
Well, good. And of course, the American Revolution did succeed in getting rid of a monarchy. And, you know, Washington was offered the monarchy. And the great thing about Washington, he's a very complicated character. You know, all our founders are complicated. Jefferson, most of all. Jefferson is really infuriating, actually. The big heroes of the American Revolution, of early America, are Ben Franklin, who is absolutely without parallel in human history, and Tom Paine, who was his apprentice, really.
An English man who spread the good word of revolution over to France, too.
Yes, he did. He did. And God knows where he got his writing ability. I mean, he was a tax collector. There's nothing in his early life that would indicate that he'd been such a great writer. But
what in your early life suggested you'd be such a great writer? I mean, you could apply your experience to his, because you can sure bounce around some stylish prose.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But actually, I've been writing since junior high school. I always loved to write. There was just something about it. It was my instrument. I tried to play the trumpet. It wasn't my instrument, but I learned to type, and that was my Beethoven moment.
You know, people sometimes think, inspiration is some kind of mystical gift. And, you know, Tom Paine was one of the first people who was a commoner who was really trying to write to inspire the average person as an average person to demand political authority and political power. If I was in that position, I'd feel pretty inspired. I don't know if I could do half as good a job as he did, but I understand where that might put some wind in your sails of confidence as you put forward your voice.
Well, he was phenomenal, Tom Paine, but, you know, he owed everything to Franklin. And you really have to look, the true father of our country was Franklin. Yeah, you have to credit Washington with sustaining the revolution. I mean, keeping the revolutionary, of course, he was a slaveholder and an Indian killer and all the things we hold against him, rightly, but he was a very complicated guy. Washington, by the way, is very gay-friendly. He hired a guy named Baron von Steuben, a Prussian, to come over and train the troops, you know, during the revolution. I mean, these guys were all farm boys, and he needed a professional. And von Steuben came over, and he was a flaming gay guy. And he showed up with a 16-year-old, you know, assistant. And Washington said, well, listen, Daniel, I don't care if you're gay, but this kid's underage. So, you know, that's how it went. Alexander Hamilton also, by the way. Hamilton was bisexual, but he had a gay lover when he was in the Army. And they shacked up together. His name was John Lawrence. And he later married a wealthy woman and had 8 kids, but you always got to wonder. So at any rate, we moved ahead. We had all this baggage we did not abolish slavery in the revolution, obviously. We did not give women equal rights. Although, interestingly, black people in 5 states in the North could vote from the very beginning of the Republic. And women were able to vote in New Jersey, which was basically run by Quakers until 1808, and then that was taken away. And not to return for many years. We abolished slavery.
I'm not quite sure that New Jersey has returned to the Quakers yet. I mean, not yet. You know, it's a difficult nut to crack for people who want to see the Democratic Party transformed.
Right. But so we want to get to that. So, you know, in my book, I talk at great length about Kennedy, the Kennedys and Lincoln, who I think were, transcendent individuals. And the great tragedy of both Abe Lincoln and Jack Kennedy is they didn't get full two full terms. You know, people spend endless hours arguing about who they were, and we could do that too. But the bottom line is they were both preternaturally intelligent. I mean, they had another level of intelligence, as did Bobby Kennedy. And we lost them. You know, we can't really fully evaluate Abraham Lincoln without having seen what he would have done in a second term.
Well, let me tell you one little thing about Lincoln, because you know, obviously reading your book and thinking about American history and knowing the complexity of these characters, and sometimes you can point to certain quotes and feel dismayed. But you get up to the Lincoln Memorial these days, and I got to tell you, Harvey, I was there recently, and I get close to it, and there's all these MAGA hats around. Because there are a lot of these Trump supporters are flocking to D.C. while they're heroes in the White House. And so there are a bunch of MAGA hats, and I walk up the stairs, you know, look at the big statue. I go to the left, and I read the beautiful language, the beautiful, powerful, radical language of the Gettysburg Address. That acknowledged right. The failings of the Republic to that point. And I just started to cry because of the damn MAGA hats. And I got out of there before I got myself in trouble. And
Abraham Lincoln wrote probably the greatest single sentence in all of American government. It's in the second inaugural, which is on the other side, if you'd have gone to the, to the other
across
side.
The way
to the right.
Is the two works of prose that are posted.
Yes, and the second inaugural said basically that now we are engaged in a great civil war, and it will proceed until every piece of wealth accumulated in slavery is destroyed, and that every drop of blood drawn by the bondsman's lash is shed in battle. And it's the purest Buddhist statement or Hindu statement of karma, of the law of karma, that you could ever imagine. And, you know, Lincoln was just such a master writer. And, you know, he also protested vehemently against the Mexican War. He had just been elected Congress. This guy was born in a log cabin that had three sides. Didn't even have it wasn't even enclosed, for Christ's sake. He gets to Congress. And the first thing he does is he opposes the Mexican War and then doesn't run again because he knows his constituents wouldn't support him. He was an amazing human being. I mean, all these quotes about this and that.
During the Polk administration.
Yes, and then Jack Kennedy, and the Kennedys don't get me going. But, you know, let's talk, you and I now, about what we really, really face here and the problem we face, which is not Donald Trump. It's the corporate Democrats. And the fact that the corporate Democrats have been around in their full obsessive and a repressive negativity, really, since 1896. And I know this sounds obscure, but in 1896, you had a populist party, you know, a very powerful third party that was based in the farming community in America. And they were very strong in the West and the South, strong enough to make a strong threat to knock out either the Democrat or the Republican Party, because we were in the midst of a serious a depression, and, you know, there were labor strikes going on, and the populists rise up, and they're going to run a third candidate who probably would have come in second. But then the Democrats nominate William Jennings Bryan. And this is the Bill Clinton and Woodrow Wilson and Al Gore and John Kerry and Hillary Clinton of the era. And this guy comes forward. He was a great speaker. He was raised an evangelical in Nebraska. And he steals the populist thunder. You know, he advocates free silver, which for various reasons the populists wanted. But the populists had a very powerful socialist agenda, or semi-socialist. And they were prepared to run a Union general named James B. Weaver and a Confederate general named Benjamin Field. They had done it in 92. And Bryan just sweeps in and blows them out. And takes the Democratic nomination. And he says to the populace, if you don't back me, you're going to wind up electing William McKinley. And he screwed him. He asked them to endorse him. And he divided the party, and they endorsed him, and then he just completely ignored him, William Jennings Bryan. And it went from there. And since 1896, you know, now right since 2016, 120 years, the Democrats have done the same thing to us. You know, they've always run someone who, left of the Republicans, you know, with the sheen of social change, just enough to undercut, you know, a Eugene V. Debs or a Bob La Follette or a Henry Wallace, but, you know, not enough to deliver real change. The only exception, of course, is Franklin Roosevelt, who, when we really talk about Franklin Roosevelt, you're talking about Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, Eleanor Roosevelt, I think, was the most powerful woman in all of American history, certainly in the 20th century. And without her, I'm not sure we would have had a new deal. So now,
I get props to Eleanor Roosevelt. And, I mean, you know, I think the issue there then becomes how quickly, following three terms plus a few years of Roosevelt, there's the reassertion of the staunchly pro-business forces within the Democratic Party. And, of course, it becomes a business-labor alliance for a few decades until that gets shattered. And, right. But coming out of the New Deal, of course, there is something along the lines of an American social democratic contract. You do see Sanders pointing back to that. Have a lot of nostalgia for that going all the way through Johnson's Great Society, which, you know, I think at the time you can actually look at not even a radical left critique, but a left critique of Johnson's Great Society that I think people can look back and see is rather resonant, that a lot of the decisions that were made there were not really going to be empowering for the communities that were directly affected. And then, of course, the Vietnam War undermined it all. And but yes, the corporate Democrats and very much what you're describing with the Williams Jennings Bryan, you can see that in the recent Democratic elections. And again, the sort of message being sent to the progressives who are active supporting other candidates, whether it be Jesse Jackson or Bernie Sanders, being sort of made to accept a situation in which there is no choice. And, you know, they're very open about this. The Clinton people were very open that they would have nowhere to go, and we really don't have to give them anything because they have nowhere to go. They can't go to the Republicans, and we're the only other choice, was their logic. And that was certainly incredibly dominant within the Democratic Party right up until, and unfortunately through, the Bernie Sanders 2016 election, because that certainly was the tact that Hillary Clinton took, and as you point out in your book very clearly, the selection of, you don't have to even look any deeper, though you can look deeper and see it all around, but you don't have to look any deeper than the selection of Tim Kaine. Tim who? Tim what?
Yeah, really.
You know, the guy was going to have Mike Pence run circles around him in the debate, you know?
Yeah.
So that was tells you where their thinking was still at. You know, I think there's been something of an adjustment, and I think this is a problem right now that a lot of progressives are going to have to face. On the one hand, the corporatist Democrats are ideologically exhausted. I mean, neoliberalism was exposed not only by the collapse of financial markets and the Great Depression that followed in 2007, 2008, but in the response to it of austerity, the boosting back up of the 1% by the corporate Democrats, by the Blair-Brown Labor Party in the UK, and a public contempt and exhaustion for neoliberalism is, and the effort to put Humpty Dumpty back together again still is not something that is attractive to people at all. And so we have a situation now where, you know, and I think tellingly, after Obama, there were no stars from that particular political movement to put forward as candidates. I mean, you look at the people who are being presented now, and they have no public political profile before they launch their 2020 presidential campaigns. And here I'm talking about Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar. The only one who really had any kind of profile at all nationally was Cory Booker, and his candidacy is going down in flames, Kirsten Gillibrand, et cetera. They went nowhere. So you do have these two politicians who have been in their own way, obviously Sanders in the way that we truly exalt, And to a lesser degree, but also in a real way, you know, Elizabeth Warren fought against the logic of neoliberalism throughout her certainly late career and the career for which she became a prominent public figure by the time of the financial crisis in 2007-2008, with her work against bankruptcy laws, her work against, you know, financial industry deregulation, the foundation of the consumer, the Federal Consumer Protection Bureau, and so on. And Joe Biden is left as the only standard bearer, really just a dinosaur politically, and he's collapsing in the polls. And we actually are looking at, again, depending on how the press, which will always try to bury Bernie Sanders, the mainstream corporate press, whether they can do further damage to his campaign because of the problem he had, his health problem that's been corrected. And I fully expect Bernie Sanders to come back stronger than ever. And I think this may make him even more of a populist hero, and populist in the best sense of the word. And by the way, I want to go back a little bit to the populist revolt. There's a great book called The Populist Revolt, fantastic book about the history of American populism in the late 19th century that harmonizes entirely with what you've said and what you've written about in your new book, Harvey. So that's an incredible work. And anyway, getting back to Sanders and Warren, we have a real chance that this could be a two-way race between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And I suppose I'm certainly going to say nothing ill about Elizabeth Warren here, but I do worry that that campaign, both because of for tactical reasons and maybe believing that somehow unity can be created between the two wings that are in the Democratic Party, the big money heretofore dying fast wing of the corporate Democrats, at least among the public, but of course a wing that still controls the power within the party, that she can form an active coalition to win the nomination. And I think that's troubling because those guys have money, they have power, they can unify a good portion of American capital and wealth and power against Donald Trump's Republican Party. And I don't believe for a second that they don't think, if they're brought into a coalition in the campaign like Warren's, that they can't ultimately contain her efforts to have the deep structural change she's campaigning for publicly. Sanders, of course, is making no such potential compromise with the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, and I don't think there's any risk of a Bernie Sanders presidency being forced into that kind of stultifying to suffocating, potentially compromise with the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. Your thoughts on that, Harvey?
Well, I think you're 100% right. And there's always the diversity issue. I mean, my line is that it took George W. Bush to get us a black president, and now it's going to take Donald Trump to get us a female president. And there is that aspect to it. I think,
a first socialist Jewish president.
Yes, right. that's true. I think that what we really have to be very clear on, and, you know, Bernie does jump the stick back and forth between being a socialist and a social democrat. And, in many ways, he's a New Dealer.
Not in his own self-identification. And I have to say, I think that's significant. And I applaud the significance of his embracing of being a democratic socialist. And I think it's telling. I think Bernie Sanders is not a social democrat. Social democracy is very much about a compromise that always has an eye towards the vibrant success of business. Now, I don't think he wants to suffocate the engine of wealth creation as it functions currently from American businesses and markets and such, as such. But I do think his primary consideration is the welfare of the average household and in particular the working class. I really do see that as his point of inflection. So I agree. His self-identification as a socialist as being hollow the way that some people on the left do.
Well, so, and I agree with you 100% on that. And here's where I think we can make the case for socialism most powerfully and most importantly, and it's going to be my next piece, which is that I think that all energy corporations over a certain size, what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, which are clearly the root cause of the climate crisis, they all must now be public owned. And, you know, this idea, because we bail them out anyway. There are every one of the major corporations that's responsible for global warming or climate change or global weirding, whatever you want to call it, is getting massive subsidies. So we need to simultaneously cut off the subsidies and take over all the major energy corporations. And that's where we jump directly into socialism. Because
right, and even where they're even when and if they were publicly owned, a very important phrase that I really encourage listeners out there to have their ears prick up whenever they hear it discussed. Because when it's being discussed, it is very important for the global climate movement, and that is the term "stranded assets." This is a serious consideration.
Yeah.
First of all, we cannot create anything more that will be even more stranded assets. All of capital's force, all of its energy is always about, well, we've done, you know, we have to make sure that we draw profit off of our previous investment. And to date, again, all of the neoliberal logic has said, well, of course you must. And of course, they allow them to continue with this development. You know, I have to say, I know no one's supposed to say anything too harsh about Barack Obama, but I suppose I'm about to.
Be my guest.
Yeah, well, you know, I was disturbed by seeing. I love Greta Thunberg, and I suppose I understand why she would go and fist bump Barack Obama, and I certainly don't know how much, you know, I don't want to be condescending, patronizing, or ageist, because she obviously knows as much or more than I do about everything, because she's clearly wise and brilliant, but, you know, she met with Obama, and of course Barack Obama then says we're partners. Well, Barack Obama, you know, he's still, as far as I know, is still actively going around boasting about America's energy independence and how proud he is that we now are the world's major exporter of fossil fuels because of the fracking boom, which he fueled. And so
he was also pro-nuclear.
Yeah, and so a real problem there around.
I got to tell you, not calling out the issues there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I got to tell you, writing this history of the United States, I really wanted to stop at 1992 and not have to deal with the Clintons and Gore and Kerry and all these, you know, corporate Democrats. And I got to tell you, I think if you held a secret election of the corporate Democrats, Gore, Clintons, Kerry, Obama, and gave them a choice between Trump and Bernie, they choose Trump, frankly. I totally agree.
And one of the reasons I agree is because I think one of the tragedies of the Trump era is it allows for a clear strategy. You can see the strategy of the neoliberals for, of a reanimation of their dead corpse, speaking
correctly
as a political movement.
Absolutely.
And a strategy back to power. Just that, you know, we got to defeat this horrible thing, and we're the centrists who can do it. Don't go too far to the left. You'll endanger yourself and risk reelecting him, which, of course, is ridiculous because he was elected over the worst kind of centrist. But I can construct a defense of Barack Obama and his presidency. And I do think that when we do look at the situation, even around the global climate emergency and understanding the centrality of the United States in terms of a true international response to the global climate emergency. Because don't forget, one of the paradoxes of the United States that to me is always so profound, we have a very undereducated, intentionally undereducated population, and yet we have the majority of scientific research capital is located inside the domestic United States because of the universities.
Yeah.
And you have the brain drain the rest of the world.
Alan Minsky, you're about to run out of time. Tell people. Alan Minsky, tell people how to get a hold of you real quick. We're about to run out of time.
Oh, my. That's right. Alan Minsky, you can reach me at alan@pdamerica.org. alan@pdamerica.org. And if we're truly out of time, Harvey Wasserman.
Almost.
It's a pleasure being with you. Tell people how they can get your book. I mean, geez, that's a masterpiece.
Well, it's at solartopia.org. It's just coming out. I hope you'll spread it around, Alan. I'd love to have used as a fundraiser for PDA. So maybe we can work on that. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the great villain of U.S. history in my book, who is none other than Woodrow Wilson. To my mind, he destroyed the Socialist Party in a fascist manner, paved the way for Adolf Hitler. We could do a whole show on Woodrow Wilson, but The bottom line is the number one problem we face in America today in the world is the corporate Democrats. And PDA is an antidote. Bernie Sanders is holding his ground, thank God. And we have got to figure out how to get the Democratic Party to be truly a progressive party. And Alan Minsky, you are really key to that. So it's been an honor talking here. We'll have you back again. Okay, brother? Talk to you soon. Thank you. Talk to you soon. From what we conceived. Either way, we got.